From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Two police officers were shot in Ferguson, Missouri overnight, apparently by a sniper, as protests continued in that city. Both officers were rushed to the hospital and were later released. The shootings occurred after a crowd gathered outside police headquarters in Ferguson as news spread that the city's police chief had agreed to resign. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder spoke about it at a press conference Thursday.
But what happened last night was a pure ambush. What happened last night was a pure ambush. This was not someone trying to bring healing to Ferguson. This was a damn punk, who was trying to sow discord in an area that is trying to get its act together and trying to bring together a community that has been fractured for too long. This really disgusting and cowardly attack might have been intended to unravel any sense of progress that exists, but I hope that that does not in fact happen. Incidents like the one we have witnessed throw into sharp relief why, you know, conversations like the one that we've convened today and that we're going to be having to build trust between law enforcement and the communities that they serve are really so important.
We'll have more on that when we speak with Glenn Ford, senior editor of BlackAgendaReport.com, later in this newscast. An international conference was held in Moscow Thursday, with the situation in the Middle East being the topic of discussion. Press TV's Marina Kortanova was there and filed this report.
The international conference, the situation in the Middle East and possible solutions to the crisis, was held in Moscow. The event gathered senior officials from several countries. The speakers voiced their opposition to external military intervention in the region, saying the consequences of U.S. military action in Iraq, Libya, and Afghanistan speak for themselves.
The situation in the Middle East can get worse according to our studies, and the cause of this deterioration is the U.S. policy in the region and the monopolization of political processes in a way that someone in the U.S. is interested in. The armed dealers get huge benefits from the resulting disorder. We must stop this process, and we shouldn't forget the boomerang effect. This chaos can return to the U.S.
The growth of terrorism was one of the most discussed topics. Experts invoked the urgent need to control ISIL's expansion in Syria, which works as an excuse for U.S. military intervention there and can ultimately disrupt the settlement of the Syrian conflict. Russian authorities expressed their willingness to help resolve the problems while respecting the sovereignty of each country. Meanwhile, the need for joint efforts to combat terrorist groups was stressed by the Arab League ambassador to Russia.
We need to find stronger methods to nip the financing of terrorist groups. It is not a secret that the money they receive, as well as their tanks or weapons, do not fall from heaven.
This conference is taking place in an institute which reports directly to the Russian President's administration. After the meeting, these materials and studies will be directed to them and the work will continue. On the basis of my recent trips to the region and today's reports, I can say that Russia doesn't interfere in the Middle East, but it's invited to stop deterioration of the situation in the region.
The main idea could be heard practically from all participants in the meeting. The way out of the Middle East crisis is in supporting legitimate governments and powers. The countries of the region must ensure their security cooperation with neighboring states and avoid requesting military intervention from the West. Marina Kortanova, Press TV, Moscow.
The ceasefire in Ukraine is still holding, but there are signs that Kiev may be preparing for a spring offensive against the breakaway republics in the east. This comes amid reports that Washington will increase military aid to the Ukrainian government and an apparent epidemic of suicide among former government officials. For more, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, an international relations and security analyst at Moscow State University, via Skype Thursday from his office in Moscow.
Yeah, let's start with the spring offensive. Okay, this is no secret. Everyone pretty much knew that Kiev agreed to the ceasefire, this new ceasefire, after breaking the last one, for only two reasons. One, most importantly, was to provide the political excuse for the IMF to shovel another $17.5 billion of taxpayer dollars to prop up their regime and so they could continue waging the war on their own people in the east. And secondly, because they were suffered a huge military defeat with their military surrounded in a cauldron in the town of Debaltseve. They lost a lot of men, a lot of military gear. They were hoping to use the ceasefire to be able to withdraw them or perhaps even to maintain that town. It didn't work out that way for them. You know, everyone pretty much agrees that this ceasefire, much like the last one, is just a tactical pause. Within the weeks after signing the last one, there was already intelligence coming out of Kiev that they had set a spring offensive date for April. They are now receiving more and more Western military gear and trainers. They also have a further incentive. We will not see the offensive start until the IMF actually delivers the cash, which hasn't happened yet. So we've probably got a few weeks there. Secondly, there is a timetable. The Ukraine has drafted the fourth wave of recruits, these massed forced conscription. But the third wave is due to expire within the next 2 months. So they have a hard – these are by now experienced. At least they have a year of training under their belts, a year of some of them, you know, actual combat. And if the Ukraine doesn't attack and lets – before it lets them go – then, you know, that would severely limit any military offensive that they might be able to put up. Second, on to the death of Alexander Plukashenko. He is the former governor of the Ukraine's Zaporozhye region, which is directly south of the Donetsk region. He is the sixth Party of Regions former official who has died of, quote, suicide, unquote, in the last month, with several more before that. He apparently was, according to the Ukrainian Interior Ministry, driven to suicide and shot himself in the neck. Shot himself in the neck.
In the neck. What? Who shoots himself in the neck?
Yeah, this is just, it's so absurd, right? It's why do they even bother lying? Why do they even bother with the lie? Of course, the Western mainstream media completely ignores this, right? We have this regime that they helped install in the Ukraine, that they're propping up, that they're arming. It's wiping out its former political opponents. I mean, they've already been lustrated. They've already been beaten in the streets, driven from office. The Communist Party banned from the parliament, right? But now they have to actually exterminate their political opponents, and the Western media is completely silent. Not a word about it. Not a word. Some insignificant opposition leader polling 2% approval rating, and whose electoral electoral bouts for his neoliberal party were 0.5%. And the Western media starts proclaiming him the next Kennedy of Russia. Meanwhile, six recently deposed government ministers in Ukraine all end up dying in a mass outbreak of quote, suicide, unquote. And they're completely silent. The moral bankruptcy of this is just beyond belief. It's beyond the pale.
So there's an epidemic, huh?
An epidemic of suicide. Watch out. I would advise that everyone avoid taking trips to Ukraine in the near future. We're expecting a CDC mental health advisory about this potential pandemic that's breaking out there.
Okay, Mark Sloboda, thank you very much. Appreciate your time, as always.
Thanks for having me, Don.
Syria was the latest country to offer solidarity with Venezuela in the face of new U.S. sanctions and other hostile actions from Washington.
These sanctions are unfair and violate international law. The U.S. is imposing its agenda on Syria, Iran, Venezuela, and Russia through its allies in the region, such as the Arab Gulf countries, which have tried to pressure Venezuela by reducing oil prices, especially after its recognition of Palestine.
Meanwhile, Miriam Kornblith, a high-ranking official from the U.S. National Endowment for Democracy, recently traveled to Venezuela to meet with right-wing opposition politicians. Diosdado Cabello, the president of the Venezuelan National Assembly, charged that the organization is used by Washington to fund terrorist and subversive groups under the guise of spreading democracy.
On Saturday, February 28th, Renee Miriam Kornblith, the Latin America and Caribbean director of the National Endowment for Democracy, or NED, landed at the Simón Bolívar International Airport in Maiquetía. This is the institution that North American imperialism uses to fund terrorist and subversive groups under the guise of being NGOs.
A top UN human rights investigator had harsh criticism Wednesday for both Mexico and the U.S. Juan Méndez, special rapporteur for the UN Human Rights Council, urged Mexico to take steps against what he called generalized torture of criminal suspects after saying that such abuse has been happening at the local, state, and federal level. He told journalists that it was very important for Mexico to realize that it has, quote, a very serious problem, closed quote, with torture, and shrugged off criticism from the Mexican government that he had not submitted more cases of alleged abuse before making his recommendations to the council, currently meeting in Geneva. Daniel Johnson filed this report from the United Nations.
Following his address at the UN, Special Rapporteur Méndez repeated his findings of generalized torture in Mexico and said he was aware of hundreds of thousands of complaints. Mr. Méndez said that old habits die hard for Mexican authorities, which said he had only uncovered 14 or 15 alleged cases of torture.
The fact that we were not able to give them hundreds of cases does not, in my mind, mean that we cannot use the term that torture is generalized.
Young boys and girls were among the victims of abuse at each level of state authority, the investigator said. Noting that the Mexican authority had given him unfettered access to prisons around the country, Mr. Méndez said that inmates told him that torture happened in the first 24 to 48 hours of detention, usually before suspects went before a judge. Daniel Johnson, United Nations.
The special rapporteur also singled out the U.S. for criticism. Press TV's Waqar Rizvi has more.
Well, the UN torture investigator has accused the U.S. of denying him access to prisons to visit inmates in solitary confinement and interview those held at the Guantanamo Bay prison. UN Special Rapporteur on Torture Juan Méndez says he has been trying to visit U.S. prisons and maximum security facilities for 2 years to check on conditions at the detention centers. More than 80,000 inmates are being kept in solitary confinement at several prisons. Méndez has criticized the United States' overuse of solitary confinement. He says spending 30 years or more under such conditions is, quote, cruel and shameful, but hiding or denying it just makes it worse. Méndez has also said that he refused a visit as the terms offered by U.S. authorities were unacceptable. The U.S. had told Méndez that he would not be allowed to have any conversation with any inmates at the prison.
Two police officers were shot in Ferguson, Missouri, apparently by a sniper, as protests continue in that city. Both officers were rushed to the hospital and later released. U.S. media seemed intent on linking the shootings to the protesters who have been organized in that Missouri city since the killing of Michael Brown last August. For more on this, we spoke with Glenn Ford, senior editor of BlackAgendaReport.com, via Skype Thursday.
When you have a country that is as violent as the United States, and it is a violence that is driven largely by state policy, well, sometimes cops are going to get shot too. But the score is certainly in the cops' favor in terms of fatalities inflicted. There are far more civilians killed than police. And in fact, being a policeman is by far not the most hazardous job in the country. Being a bodega owner is.
It's true. The fatalities are fairly, extremely low, actually. In fact, more police officers die in car crashes than from being shot. The movement, or in any event, the activity that has been developing over the, certainly over the period since last summer with Michael Brown's killing, still seems mobilized. I was chatting with a journalist this morning who was in Moscow, and she's an intelligent person and well-informed, and you know, she's not an organizer. So she was wondering why there was even a protest last night, since the police chief had resigned and the city manager and stuff. Is like, haven't you, you know, didn't they win? And I obviously people are still mobilized. You want to talk about that? Like, what kind of tasks are still ahead, what path there might be to achieving some of these things?
Maybe the better question is why in the past two generations there have not been more incidences or more upheavals and rebellions in the black community. We have only the punctuation in terms of major rebellions of the Rodney King rebellion in 92, separating these within this two-generation span of time. Every single rebellion of any size among blacks in the United States has been sparked by some kind of atrocity by the police. And that's held true since the first of the urban rebellions, the large ones in Harlem in 1935. So again, with the worsening conditions among black folks, certainly post 1980, and with the horrific pressures that have been put on the black community, the criminalization of a whole people by this mass black incarceration state, well, we should wonder why Ferguson didn't arrive a lot sooner.
You know, with the Hollywood version of American society, or the CNN version even, the underlying frustration of black folks in the days of Jim Crow, whether the North or South version of that, you know, festering beneath the surface, got set off by these, you know, incidents of police brutality at different times, and yeah, even ended up producing a movement like Emmett Till, for example. His murder helped to spark an awful lot of things that followed for another 10, 12 years. But now, the image is that, and even from Hollywood, you have black faces in Hollywood across the board. You have this whole idea that we are in a post-racial society. Why is it exactly that people were set off so easily? I mean, again, you say that it should have been happening much more frequently in over the last three decades. But what are the underlying problems that are festering now that are the lighter fluid for these conflagrations?
You know, that is certainly the mystery, and people's subjective behavior is always a mystery to other people. I suppose we don't know why we do the things that we do. I could put forth the theory that the onset of this mass black incarceration state around 1970 might have been such a shock, the unrelenting pressure from police and in every part of the country might have been such a shock to black America that it caused a kind of fear of confrontation with police that was based in the material fact that sentences were longer, that you could get your you could be physically damaged much more quickly, that the job market became a lot tighter, and the penalties for getting a criminal record therefore more severe, and that at some point black folks got inured to the violence of police and accepted it as just part of the environment. That's just a thought on my part. And at some point, maybe with the ascension of of a black president and a rise in expectations among folks that were not realized, certainly in terms of the behavior of the police, well, that two-generation-long spell was broken. But this is all speculation on my part and everybody else's, too.
You know, something that something I've seen in the media, you have these various flashes of evidence of overt racism in the United States that the myth always had done away with in, you know, with the signing of the Civil Rights Act or something. And since the President Obama was elected, there has been an entirely new cottage industry of racist cultural artifacts, for lack of a better term, exhibited pretty openly and treated as if it were just, you know, sheer political commentary, partisan political commentary that shouldn't offend in this post-racial world. After all, we did elect a black president. Why can't we call him using the N-word or something? What do you think about all of that? Because there's such a weird mix of contradictions around that entire subject.
Yeah, it's not only all right to be racists, but it's not all right to call somebody a racist. The taboo has been switched. The script has been flipped on us. And we have gotten to the point where, according to polls, a majority of white people now believe that whites are the most discriminated against class in the United States. An absolutely insane idea, but the one that apparently is held by a majority of white people. So there exists, it appears, a kind of white consensus that they're not going to take any more flack from black folks who have no reason to complain and must be maliciously intent on inflicting reverse racism on them.
So how do you counter this?
Well, I'm not sure how black folks can act as psychiatrists for white people. What we have to do is organize ourselves in ways that create change in our own communities, and see if the presence of an aware and active and taking no nonsense black community actually has some kind of therapeutic effect on a white community that is suffering from extreme cognitive failure. That is, they can't see that which is right in front of their noses, but imagine that they see all kinds of things that are not there, like reverse racism run amok.
Sounds like you're maybe recommending the kind of therapy that our grandparents gave us when we stepped out of line sometimes.
I'm recommending the kind of therapy that this nascent movement seems to be prepared to give, to stand up and shout out that the oppression of black folks will not be tolerated. It's not only real, it's unacceptable, and the contradictions will be brought home to those who are creating the contradictions. You have to make folks think about what is real, or they get carried away with what they imagine.
One of the constraints on overt, to the extent there were any, overt racist violence by the state during the post-war period was concern among the elites here that the example of the U.S. and the way it treats black folks here, as opposed to what socialist countries were speaking of in terms of race and every other issue in terms of class, that the U.S. was looking bad internationally, and that it risked, as it was trying to recolonize Africa or hold on to colonies there for on behalf of Europe and in Asia, that it risked projecting a racist face to people that they needed to partner with or to try to dominate. That constraint doesn't exist anymore. What do you see as the international dynamic to the situation in the United States?
Well, with the U.S. as the sole superpower and having no competition in the world that it recognizes, it becomes the racist buck run amok. And we can see the ramifications domestically. I think one good example is in racial profiling. You know, around the late 1990s, it was amazing. Even a pessimist like me was heartened by the fact that even hardcore Republicans were swearing on their mothers that they were opposed to racial profiling, and they were taking pledges to fight against racial profiling. And racial profiling became the big no-no in the United States by consensus and acclamation. And then we had 9/11, and racial profiling certainly of Muslims, became the law and culture of the land, and racial profiling of the usual kind against black folks was no longer the no-no, no longer a taboo. It just was submerged in the whole hysteria of a country that thought that everybody in the world is out to get it. So the internal enemy became even scarier to the American people, representing a kind of ISIS next door, if you will.
And then there's the racial profiling of immigrants as well. I'm wondering if there's a way of drawing the threads of a whole cloth, looking at the treatment of black folks in the United States, and its treatment of people in Africa, Asia, Latin America.
That's very interesting. The new United Front in South Africa, which includes the most progressive elements of the union movement, the breakaway factions of the African National Congress, all kinds of folks coming together in South Africa are seeing the connection between the Black Lives Matter movement, the anti-police abuse movement in the United States, and their own situation in the majority black country of South Africa, where black lives don't seem to matter either. So they're marching on the U.S. Consulate in several cities in South Africa, but condemning their own black-led government as well for, in blackface, carrying out policies towards the people that one associated in the past with the racist white regime.
And back in the day, folks here, Panthers certainly, and others, were looking to China, which was the largest power, non-white, non-European power in the world, and clearly rising at that time even, for support. And now China is about to be, if it's not already, the largest economic power in the world. Do you see a role for China in sort of countering the existing condition, both in Africa and Latin America and even here in the United States?
Yeah, I don't think the Chinese people have forgotten for one second the humiliation, the centuries of humiliation that they suffered under all of the European powers and the United States. And the Korean people don't forget, and the Vietnamese people don't forget. These are memories that are embedded in the national psyches of those folks. So our reservoir of potential friends remains out there in the world. It is up to us to find ways to initiate a common conversation that can lead to that can bear fruit for us politically here.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.